So, Adam Horovitz, the author of Turning and Only the Flame Remains, which was written as poet in residence at Stroud's Museum, and A Thousand Laurie Lees. Oh, it's a lovely ramble, really, through a place and memories about the spirit of the man and the spirit of a place. Gillian Clark writes, Adam Horovitz comes of age as a poet in these vivid poems of love and loss, joy and grief, place and memory. Adam is currently Herefordshire's poet in residence, and we're going to start with some reading.
And I'm going to open with some poems, particularly about the valleys around Stroud. The first is A House Built from Cloth. I grew up in a house built from cloth, played in the ruins of cottage industry, old stones like teasel teeth chewing at my feet. Fragments of industry, their lime wash white faded to a smoker's gold. I grew up in a valley stretched over stone like cloth, rolled footballs and roller skates over sheep felted grass, built locks in the stream under the old trade road. I grew up in a landscape where hedges and dry stone walls ran through the fields like seams, where the past was a runic language stitched, dyed and woven into oracular hills. Time settles like ordered cloth in these valleys, catches itself red-handed as it is folded back. I grew up watching the past, pulling the weight of the future along the canal's linear thread. A little note about the line towards the end, catches itself red-handed. There is rumour that this phrase originated in Stroud, because Stroud made Stroud Red, the cloth that clothed the thin red line, and thieves trying to steal it when it was stretched out on the hill would be caught red-handed. And there are other places that try and make claim to it, but I say it's from Stroud. The next poem is called Burials, again, deeply embedded in the landscape. Burials. I remember you telling me of a burial years ago in Elcombe Woods, up at the high point, the stony point, where local workmen chewing their cud of cider refused to work. They told the husband that his wife would get no further down than 3 feet, you said, although the grave was eventually dug. You seemed astonished, questioned the sanctity of such an act, siding in Protestant horror with the old rogues buried in their pints, who mix and match their myths to suit the night. You closed off when I told you I had dug the grave with the family of the deceased 2 years before, had stood at 6'4", shoulder deep in consecrated earth, carving out a fragment of the hill. It was as if I disappointed you, gave you a truth you did not need, intruding on your tale with pick and spade. All stories tell truths, I know that now. Unwritten memories and bodies subside like pit villages, but they leave small spaces where hot poppies and dandelions grow amongst resurgent grass. All burials are beginnings. I wrote A Thousand Laurie Lees directly for the centenary, to mark Laurie Lees' centenary last year. And I was then asked to be poet in residence for Stroud's Museum, as Chloe said. And these poems came as a reaction to, well, this Laurie, you're wonderful, my valley now. And the pamphlet opens, and this will become relevant in a minute, with a quote from April Rise by Laurie. Now, as the almond burns its smoking wick, dropping small flames to light the candled grass, now, as my low blood scales its second chance, if ever world were blessed, now it is. Dear Laurie, since you are no longer able to be lured from the fields, the long grass, the sun's last liquid blink to join me for a pint in the hill eye of the Woolpack, I have invited the valley in for a pint of Yulee, watched it pull its roots up drowsily, and hoist those high branches into a gilded blazer as it squeezes into man shape, slides like autumn through the door. It looks a little bit like you, though that's a given according to the barman who wears a hair shirt of cider, a lopsided smile. I do not care about its looks, lost instead in awe at the way when, finally, it speaks. The words spill out as seeds and make a sudden forest of the floor. As part of the centenary celebrations, a group based around Stroud called Walking the Land asked me to do a tour of Slad the day after the centenary cider festival. This poem came of it. It's dedicated to Jessie Lee, Laurie's daughter, who very sweetly gave me permission to write 1,000 Laurie Lees, as long as it wasn't actually a biography of Laurie. We've had enough of those. This is The Tour Stops at Laurie's Grave for Jessie Lee. As I read April rise for tourists at your father's grave, on a hot, still day just past 100 years since he was born, a small girl, not listening to anything but the valley's whispered clamour, poked her hand into a hole built from ivy on the trunk of a neighbouring tree, sang quietly to herself as she rustled in its depths, her fingers an inquisition for spiders, woodlice, sun. Then, the way cleared, she played peekaboo with Swift's Hill. If ever world were blessed, now it isn't. Now it is. Now it isn't. Now it is. And the final poem in this section is kind of about reclaiming the valley. I grew up in a thumb offshoot of Slad. From the Woolpack, you go deep into the valley where the roads run out and you're basically falling 30 years backwards in time. This is Waiting for the Flame. This is where people are buried, in rooms made dark by paper, which bursts like frozen lightning from boxes leant against the walls, the blackened beams. Digging in, we find memories bent and stiff in their winding sheets of dust, ossuaries of forgotten sorrow, a paper bag full of childhood's hair. New boxes, packing tape, a hard few days of delicate rehousing. The 70s are flung from the window in a tumble of old-fashioned advertising. Quash, Walker's Crisps, Bulmer's Apple Juice, a cash-and-carry avalanche. Cardboard cities form in the garden, waiting for the flame. I hold letters up for inspection, find poems I've never read in my mother's hand amongst old photographs of her naked in the garden, an awkward delight latched to her smile. The sun is caught in monochrome. It licks at her hair, her breasts, a fire in the dark. I imagine her clothed and colourful. I put away the pictures, head blurrily down treacherous stairs. These are the archive hours, the times of troubling to look back and back, then forward through the painful heat of curiosity and hope to what can at last be saved. My father, too frail now to lift the boxes, carries memories on his shoulder as if they were wood for some burnt offering. He salts the bread he says he must eat little of with tears. I stand in the garden until the fire dances up and almost out. Cardboard sparks weave amongst heat-stricken leaves, rehearsing autumn. Clouds tuck up the stars, and I am glad I've crawled out of the dust of us into the valley's glittering dress of rain to watch lightning spread in sheets over the hill. There is no thunder now. Only the flame remains.
That's really lovely, thank you. It's so interesting when you hear somebody read something and you've been reading it yourself. The bit when you said that she played peekaboo with Swift's Hill in The Tour Stops at Laurie Lee's Grave, and you've got that line at the end which says, if ever world were blessed, now it isn't, now it is, now it isn't, now it is. And I read that as quite a sad, you know, there was something very ambivalent, but sort of in a way quite fragile and sad in some ways. But the way you read it, there was a real sort of emphasis on the ears, and I think that's... Do you find you read it differently every time? Or
No, the emphasis, because it's riffing off the quote from April Rise, which is a very emphatic, positive, now it is, if ever world were blessed, now it is. It's always felt like positive to me. I mean, obviously, reading to oneself on the page, poem becomes yours to do as you will with. But that's how I see it.
So. Yeah, it is so interesting, that difference between hearing something and reading something, isn't it? And how when you have a reading, you get introductions and you get kind of that sort of input. But obviously, when you're reading it on your own, you're just there much more, as you say, with your own imagination. I think a good place to start, obviously, is the Valley for you. And I mean, it struck me to ask whether you'd ever leave SLAD now. Is it because, you know, it's such a place in your writing, is it?
It's certainly the place. It's not everything I write about. It's a place that, I mean, there are the poems in the pamphlet about walking through the valley, and it is a place of inspiration. Going through the woods, I mean, much as my mother did. There's a poem of hers in her collected called Walking in Autumn, which is about just a long walk through that valley. And it's a place of inspiration for that, and it could be about anything. It could be a vast political rant, which has happened. I come rushing back from a walk out in the sun, in the evening, and written down completely and utterly unrural, unpastoral things. But the valley is totemic.
Yeah, that's certainly right. It is, isn't it? It's not. I don't see you as a sort of landscape poem in some poet in some ways, but that somehow the place is giving you something that you're. It's. Yeah. Well,
it's been a long 18 years. I've moved back. I mean, I moved out just after college and lived all the way to Stroud. and my father, who's mostly based in London, kept it on, kept it empty. It's not empty, Adam. It's got my papers in it, which is terribly much a poet's point of view. I had been itching for the last 10 years to move back. And I don't see myself leaving unless something drastic happens. So.
When you write about a place, one of the lovely things in this, I mean, I don't know if anyone else agrees with me, but this child putting her hand in the hole of the tree in the tour stops at Laurie's grave, she's got, everybody else is sort of looking at the grave and the kind of, that's supposed to represent Laurie Lee, but she's got her hand inside the hole and she's fiddling around with the woodlice and looking for the spiders. And that's just such a beautiful, that I felt that must be what Laurie Lee would be about, what the child is doing.
Certainly, I mean, the reason I dedicated it, the poem to Jessie was, apart from her being kind of addressed directly anyway, is that she was getting very fed up with the amount of kind of media pressure and being stitched up by the Daily Mail and so on and wanted things to get back to what mattered, to Laurie, which was the writing, the art, and the valley, and not necessarily in that order, and the drink actually, but that's just Laurie.
Should we have some more poems?
Sure. Another thing, another part of what I've written about, as some of you may know, my mother was also a poet, Frances Horowitz, died in 1983 when I was 12, and I started to write properly, seriously, as a kind of a way of keeping up a correspondence with her after her death, and you know, slowly built myself up into writing. So much of, as Waiting for the Flame kind of intimated, much of this book deals with the kind of the over distance and time, the after effects of her death. And this first poem is called Fugue. And always it comes back to this once school is shut away. A badger in my room, its raw earth and sawdust stench on my tongue, needle fur salting and souring my cheek. And beneath the fur, the press of tarmac, skin scarred, dented by a hard fist of car, the subtle musk of an unclenched boot, warm as a womb. And in my room, the careful shadow of a taxidermist stalking pools of cloth, upturned boats of words, glass eyes skittering in his hand like coins, the driver's grief like a pillar of rain, a knock of daylight on the window. Elsewhere, the wet earth turned, the pile diminishing, the set like an unfilled grave. And in my arms, the badger, held back from its river crossing till I load it with fury to carry off into the dark. And because fugue, the reason, that's the opening poem in this collection, and because fugue is, it means two things. One, a musical style where themes repeat and come back and are built upon, and also a difficult circular emotional state. There are lots of poems about badgers in here, so this is one of them. Last night she saw badgers. This was when I was living in Ross. At the school gate is John Curl High School in Ross-on-Lye. Last night she saw badgers. He stands at the school gate, hunched and trembling, like a tree at winter's rise. The air is glue. I wade to him, each step taking all of my 12 years. He is grey as the rope we found in Orkney, coiled and faded on the cliffs of Ronaldsay, worn out with hoping for the rescue that would never come. The car is waiting. We must go to London now, he says. Death waits in the car unspeaking. I too am silent, the blood rushing in my ears like howling trees is noise enough for me. I do not grasp the journey. It is over in moments. I am contracting time to reach my mother in her sad bed in the stale ward where my two plastic Star Wars toys stand against the coming dark. Too long I have waited in the deathly quiet of the vicar's house, unspeaking, ungrateful, mapping out how I will run away to London. Too long without news and contact, the dreams I'd shared with her as a child rising again like tides too urgent for the moon to pull them back. Last night she saw badgers, he tells me, as we walk into the hospital. I remember walking with her to see a badger's set on the other side of the valley. The orderly piles of dung, the cowslips, the dust. Last night she saw badgers at the end of her bed. The next poem is a longer poem, which is subtitled From Experience to Innocence for My Father. It's called The Great Unlearning. And it moves through several landscapes, Herefordshire being one and the valley another. The Great Unlearning. This age and sourness bewilders. Where did it come from, the closeness, the urge to hurt? What umbilical cord binds us? What cancer courses through our emailed wars? The younger I become, the less sure I am. And now your computer has been taken away, you are phoning in demands for the help I have not given, because my girlfriend, who has left me in a fit of joy, has taken all my time. I start to work less because I am unremembering. Disgorging books and CDs back into shops where they wait to be unmade. Poems are rising back into my pen. I am lonely now, our communication a necessity despite this inexplicable, unhealed wound in my head that every time leads to screaming, the storms before the calm. You are filling out, unwrinkling, wiping on a beard with a drying razor. I watch it later, shrinking into your chin as I try to iron creases back into my clothes. Hurt swells like a flood before the rains rise as we stumble the natural path towards childhood, watching your siblings unbend, your mother's hip heel as she leaps from the floor of Leaside Crescent. We try sharing a house between bouts of university. It gets easier as I become less self-reliant, more naive, start shedding friends to hide in a wounded valley where a stone house has pulled itself together over years to meet our needs. Now school is coming, the great unlearning. I get to know less about people and stop smoking. It is a relief, but the pain increases and we don't know how to stop it. We walk into the office of a child psychologist who tangles up our thoughts until they resemble knots of wood. Now, as stupid arguments about cucumbers become mere lunch, I find myself standing tall after a fortnight in hospital, learning how not to walk. I'm much less tall than I used to be. My shoulders hunch like walnuts. My head is low. The bright flush of youth at odds with years of unsourced grief. And now I am packing my bags, heading for Herefordshire. A woman I meet at the bus stop yells at me about ingratitude and takes me to her house, where another man claims me as his son. Although it is all too strange for words, it does not feel wrong. Your late-night phone calls release me to his care, but still hurt leers inside me like a gargoyle, and none of us can explain it or let it go. We are too wounded by things unimagined, unexplained. The new man and his partner have another child in the house. Our mutual dislike wavers, softens into wary hope, until he leaves with his mother for Bristol, where I will not know them. I am moved to a smaller house, where the smell of sweat and sorrow rises like a molehill in the master bedroom. I'm taken to a place where poems are unsaid, harps packed away, and the bright, hard light of tearing down appearances hardens into tears as we leave for a churchyard. There, all the people we have ever known refill the ducts in their eyes and sigh. They are younger than I remember them. Years of sorrow lie like clods of earth on their shoulders. I see you there with the woman you have been with for years, who I am only now beginning not to love. Then a box bursts from the ground, showering earth in an orderly pile at the side of a deep hole. It is carried away on the shoulders of six men to a place of alchemy and miracles. Joy builds in me over several weeks, brick by painful brick, until I am taken to London to meet my mother. In her hospital bed, she wakes. Delirium becomes pain. She cries out as they siphon morphine from her. You are with me again, taking me to movies. You dance and sing, play the fool deliciously. We become joyous in each other's company, feeling our way to unconditional love now my mother is alive. There is a tender divorce in my mother's bedroom. Two friends, like flowers waiting for the hedgerow, stand witness by the small, dark window as she and the man who was my stepfather unbind into the freedom of each other. We move to Sunderland, where I unlearn the hard ways of the city, shrug off the coalface, the politics of hardship, and become innocent. But still there is pain. Over 4 years, my mother falls slowly out of love. At first, she takes to answering your late-night calls about the leaking pipes that healed themselves as the snows rose. The weary burden of their absence becomes joy. I am content to be where she is, reveling in the newness of her, in the selfishness of youth. I see you rarely, contemplating the distances between us only on empty 4-hour journeys up country from King's Cross. But the need for you throbs in my mother's ear. Her blood, her womb. Then tuneless dustmen bring us plastic bags. The evidence of your devotion is disgorged. Sunderland unpicks itself, is packed in boxes. All the time I am reducing, my red hair becoming golden. There is a white cloud of hope in me. Time is expanding to encompass it. The days are endless. I am coming back to you. All pain forgotten as you leave London and its women, return to the quiet, glacier-cut valley, the stone house we hid in, shouting years ago. It is paradise. The stream sings of the sea it is leaving as we play in it. I lose all trace of troll under the old stone bridge you spring across, goatishly. My mother unnames the flowers, plants sheep skulls in garlic groves. They gather a bramble of bone, muscle, skin and wool over the winter, bleat back into life as leaves dance up, greening to the trees. We dance too, ecstatic in her wake, pour cheese and onion crisps secretly into their bags and seal them, laugh as the cat who walked out of the fire years ago absorbs its kittens in your attic, unmesses your papers. Only one doubt remains. How will you bear it when, all too soon, I am gone? And given that that poem is addressed to my father, there are also two poems that I stress are not strictly autobiographical, about Daedalus, but they are dealing with fatherhood. The first is Daedalus Laments. It was nothing but bickering in the prison we built ourselves. Reason was lost in the labyrinth. We slept on cushions of boredom, whiled away the lichen hours in helpless dreaming. Icarus spent too much time seeming busy as he abstracted the feathers I'd saved to forge our passage out. I worked, and all he learned was endless variations on the theme of no, not preparations for our eventual escape. I was cased in a scribbled husk of absence, darkness. I longed for the sun, for all I'd lost, fell into a maze of work tied down by obsession, sublimation. Sometimes I would look up from my bench, unsure if it was bull or boy, pawing and shivering in the clammy dark. And what Daedalus saw. A long sleep that smelled of death. That's all we had in the cave dark, in the sealed up maze. Voices called to us through tubes, a torment of fragments and a few sweet whispers that melted into the dank of dream. Then the light came, the wings to the world, and we went up into the sun, the pieces of our lives remade in rivulets of wax. The last poem I'm going to read in this section is the poem that triggered those two. After I read it on National Poetry Day in 2009 at the 100 Club, and somebody came up to me, a young musician and poet, and argued with me about my interpretation of Icarus in this. And this was written thinking, staring at Bruegel's painting, the Fall of Icarus, not knowing about the Orton poem at the time. I wouldn't have dared otherwise write this, and also having a year before worked writing poems about celebrities, politicians and other scoundrels for a PR company's website. I was so glad when that finished to give up my subscription to Heat magazine, which I was forced to buy, and have never ever gone back to it. But this is the poem that came as the brewing up of those two things. The death of Icarus. We watched him fall, saw the great gold coin of sun tip him from the sky, heard the hiss of wax on water. He had been perfect, an alabaster god among men, and we loved his daring, watching him pirouette on heady air, our hands at our brows, masking the light. But we also watched, dispassionate, when he plummeted like a broken pigeon into the sea's maw. His death was swift and silent, and when his body washed up on the beach, we studied his broken neck, snapped like driftwood, the rime of salt souring his bloodless lips. We watched gulls pick out the pearls of his eyes with a jeweller's steady care, his dead legs dancing in jerky rhythms to the tune of the tide. Then we plucked those feathers that remained to fill our pillows, covered him in sand, and walked back slowly to our ploughs, waiting in eager silence for the next man who would be God to fly and fall, fly and fall.
It's very interesting to compare your version of Icarus with Orton's. And it seems to me that, I mean, that in a way they are, of course, very, very different in approach and style, but they have something in common in that in both poems there is this sense of, well, with Orton, of total indifference and unawareness and, you know, just dismissiveness, really, unawareness, I suppose, whereas in your poem there's also indifference, but it's a malicious indifference, I think, that there is, again, a sort of shoulder-shrugging malice there. And, I mean, you've got this desperate, dramatic tragedy happening, but neither your watchers nor Orton's watchers are really engaged with it at all, not in any proper sense of that word. So I think the two go together very nicely, if I can say so.
Well, thank you. I'll take that and run with it.
It struck me when I was listening to the compliment which I would use.
Thank you.
Do you think your interpretation was coloured by writing scandals about? Because it seems very negative and...
It is very much coloured, and I mean, in fact, it's. I mean, one of the things that this young musician who came up to me afterwards said, he and I ended up collaborating on a libretto that was performed a couple of years ago. I wrote Daedalus, he wrote Icarus, so much has come of it, but it is not necessarily my interpretation of the myth. That's not necessarily what I believe, but. It is an interpretation, yes. My aunt, my very aged aunt, in fact, after she read it, phoned me up from Israel and said, "But Icarus is a hero. You can't do this to him." In a strong Germanic accent, but... I agree, I can't, but the poem is still there.
And when I said to you, what about the greater learning, you know, and asked you about that, and I think you said to me, did you say, it would be great to read that. I don't often get to read that because my dad won't let me.
No, it's often, often, I haven't read it very often because it's quite a long poem.
Yeah, that too.
I remember when I read it in 2011, you said to me afterwards, Brenda, oh no, he's announced a long poem.
Well, that's from bad history.
Thankfully, he seemed to have forgiven me for it afterwards.
Absolutely. There are long poems and long poems.
Yeah. But also because it's one of those things that, you know, that there are poems and they're dealing with fatherhood. And my father, it is an interpretation, it is not necessarily the right one. There's the Rashomon effect, which he does understand, but still. Struggles occasionally with that poem, so I don't read it often when I'm with him.
But how did it come up? How did you come to write it?
It's one of there aren't many poems that I've published that are from workshops, but that was written in 2009 at a workshop at Tynewyth, run by Gillian Clark and Carol Ann Duffy. And Carol Ann, having written. Well, she wrote the last post but after that, but also another one going backwards, addressed to her mother, threw this out as a possible exercise. Write something going backwards. Don't make it too kind of personal, close, or emotional. Half an hour later, we were given half an hour to write. I'd written the basis of that poem, which is 172 lines long, and it took a month to edit it, pretty much to the exclusion of work for the PR company that I was working for at the time, who got very fed up with me indeed. But it came out in a giddy rush. This is often how I write, actually, is things to come out almost formed, just needing, well... It's like, my ex-girlfriend is a stonemason, and her description, it's true of Michelangelo, apparently, I've read things, but you look at a piece of stone, a block, and you chip, and you get through to what you can see inside it, and that's very much, particularly with that poem, that's how it worked, but it's true of much of my other writing, which comes out, either it just gets disposed of, or it's there, and I can see something in it, and I chisel away.
Chisel to find it, yeah. I mean, I think it's really, it's a brilliant, the energy in the poem is there, really so strong, but it's that thing of going at something at a slant, isn't it, that sometimes can just really, or, you know, doing something random with something, so you've got something you want to write about, and then you just attack it from a different angle, and it frees you to write about something, perhaps.
Yes.
And also it means there's all kinds of wonderful details, like somebody shaving back on their beard or sort of all these really surreal things, which are...
That I can freely confess, my father took issue with that. I don't use a wet razor. I couldn't really get the power of the description with an electric... I tried, but no.
Or the aunt sort of leaping back up from the floor. That's such a sad thing, but the way it's done, it kind of lightens something that's obviously something to use.
The crux of it is, and I mean, after that hysterical half an hour of writing it, I looked at it and realised that really what it was a love poem to my father. And these are always difficult and contentious things.
Yeah, that's right. And I feel that, you know, if that final thing about writing about things that happen to you that are personal and writing poems, they've been described as passionate and emotional, and that directness is something that I think is what it's great. It's my answer to, it's how I would answer Jeremy Paxman when he says, oh, poetry is, you know, there's nothing, you know, ordinary people can't connect with poetry. But then you listen to Adam's poems and actually that is, they're worked and there's loads in there to sort of delve around with. But they're also, you know, they're emotional and direct. And I think that's our...
Thank you.
Get Paxman next year.
Yeah, listen to it. Yeah.
But, I mean, no, I mean, I think that there can be a problem when poetry gets too lost in the university system. And don't get me wrong, there's some amazing things come from that. But it can get very lost in this little circular world where it just stays within itself. I mean, Adrian Mitchell's, I'm probably going to get this slightly wrong, but most people ignore most poetry because most poetry ignores most people. And it can be dense, it can be difficult, it can be complicated, but if it isn't ignoring people, then people aren't going to ignore it. And what I write is, there's always, because of the chiselling, there's always something much deeper. It's written to be performed, it's written to be spoken to people. I've because of my upbringing, with my mother reading for the BBC, my father, one of Britain's first performance poets, and I've always had an eye on the stage, but it's always got to have some level of craft and hidden agenda and kind of arcana in it.
Well, would you like to read your...
Read the last.
Yep.
These are mostly newish poems. And the first one I'd like to read is going back again to my mother. But this was commissioned for the little booklet at the back, which is 12 Poems of Christmas, Volume 7. I was asked to write a Christmas poem. I was actually asked to write one last year, and I said, I don't have any Christmas poems. I don't like Christmas. Christmas is difficult and strange, and I'm half Jewish. It's mostly an excuse for going and eating with family. And then Caroline, who's edited the book, got back in touch this year and said, right, I need a Christmas poem from you. How soon do you need it? A couple of weeks? And it coincided with just being asked to be Herefordshire Poet in Residence. So this is Orcock Christmas. That final Christmas, I hunted for Orcock's holy thorn along lanes narrowed by bronze-black leaves, peered through hedgerows starved of birdsong into winter-dithered pasture, sought the miraculous promissory wink of white December stars. I found no field feast of light, no hawthorn where I'd read it stood, just cigarettes in the verge, 9 rattling in a 20-box. I climbed a tree, belched gouts of votive smoke across the lane, and, for the last time willingly, I prayed. Back home, my mother said, a Christmas quest, and laughed, although it hurt. She held my cheek. You're not quite Galahad, nor Gawain with that hair. The thorn died in a storm 2 years ago. I'm sure I said. Tear clenched, I withdrew, until fire lit the kitchen for a feast. We sat to eat, firm rods of lurcher chin pressed to our laps, witness to the one small miracle the day allowed. My mother, briefly strong again amongst the hedgerow hallows that wreathed the room, a passing grace that hid in smoke, the way the cancer kept shaving her to light. The next poem was written a couple of years ago for a website called Verskraken, a magazine website called Verskraken, asking people to write poems riffing off strange things they put up on the website. And one of the things they put up, the one I responded to, was a fairy tale by Madame Dolnoy called The Girl Fish. And it doesn't really matter what happens in the fairy tale. Just know that she is transformed first from a fish to a deer to a bird, and on her way through the forest she encounters a prince. This is love poem disguised as a fairy tale. In her eyes, the girl she was, the hard, unthinking rifle shot of youth. They are urgent as a cat's yowl in the dark rooms of home, when nothing matters but the way fish lifts wet, unspeaking from the plate. She is dear now, but for those eyes. They dance through me, demanding to be spared. Another life is on her. She whispers from the soft purse of her dear's mouth that she still has much to do. I love her, and I always have. I never saw her until now. I will return to my palace of books, hungry though I cannot eat for thinking of her, as she runs through the bright wood, a spare change of terror jangling in her girl's eyes, crab apples crunching like years beneath her feet. My hunt is over. All I can do is wait for the changes to cease, for the drifting powers that drive her to other skins to calm their churning, for her to find me again with her girl's eyes and hope that the woman she's becoming under feather, hide and scale can see beyond the way I've learned in her absence to stiffen like a startled deer. And the next poem, and the final two poems are both to do with the centenary of the First World War. I was commissioned, asked by Cheltenham Poetry Festival a couple of years ago to write something to do with relating to Ivor Gurney. And this is what I came back with. Stopping with a bicycle on a hill above Stroud, thinking of Ivor Gurney. Five valleys splay below me like a broken hand encased in mud. From this high point, I see open veins of streams running in rivulets towards the Severn's metallic, distant slice of light and water. I stand beside a hedgerow that's been growing cancerous for years from the broken wall my bike is parked against. It was shrub and bramble when I cycled past it lazy on my way to school. It rages now like a negative of fire held still against the winter sky. And I think of Gurney casting back from Flanders with his pen at a different angle to take the same landscape in as if it were breath. The road is quiet, no traffic on the way from Bisley, only buzzards and the ghosts of babies whose unchristened road deaths centuries back formed the town below. A new form, the perfections of flowers and petal and blade. But landscapes shift. Wild spaces are surrounded. They look starker for it, stranger, briefly into litter, into seeds. Mankind's interactions wane and wax. Old walls collapse. New ones clatter up the sky like angry pigeons. A sheep in the field turns to bleat at me, as if surprised by the tyrannies of change. What would we recognize, Gurney and I? The Severn's progress, like a scarred, unbroken sword, shot through with filigrees of winter light. The aching yell of gulls flown eastward after ploughs. The way the sun sinks like a cuticle into a skin of cloud. The foreboding sense, something new we can't be part of. What rides this dusk like a pheromone? The bicycle calls me to the hill, the wind. The last hawk dive into Friday night. No more listening to spectres, no more pauses on cold hills to mourn the sun. The earth that ploughs forgets protestation in its turning. Those last two lines are a direct quote from Gurney. And the final poem was written in August last year. I think it was August the 4th, the day set aside for commemoration, where everyone was invited. It was suggested everyone lit a candle and contemplated the beginning of the great foolish war in 1914. And I lit the candle, and I sat, and I was there more than an hour. But this is what came out, with a little bit of honing afterwards. Commemoration hour. A moth-cut flame sputters out of silence in my kitchen, draws insects whining through the window's crack. They sing like distant biplanes, dogfight dancing at the edge of sight. I watch red wax spill over the candle's battered lip and think of family, long dead, the quiet men on unquiet fronts who let the rituals of their religion slide away, buoyed up on propaganda, desperation, hunger, as they wrote loving letters in the dark, succoured only by a single flame, by the guttering distances of home. Oh, how they dreamed of family, gave thanks to God for the minuscule mercies of the Weekly Post when it got through. But even the gentlest men will break inside when bombs and snipers dictate their diet, when all the animals of hell come crawling out from under mud on sinews of metal clasping at the bone. What precisely did they die for, or limp home wounded with? My grandfather never said, sitting in silence with his memories in the garden of his weekend home, until he was forced to cross Germany's borders and escape into England 2 decades on. Great Uncle Martin could not say, splintered in 1915 by enemy fire, only his letters remain, regaling his dearest sister Roschen with brotherly bravado, detailing requests for the essentials, paper, food and pens, whatever news might make it through the lines from home. The candle's spitting out its last 100 years on, but still the news is limited and grim. The insect whine of war continues. Tanks rumble through my kitchen whenever the fridge fires up. Commemoration wears an ugly celebratory mask. Its eye holes stare us down like guns, and from its mouth a fine gas seeps. Gas! Quick, boys! An ecstasy of fumbling in the press, the ways to not quite say we won, we won, we won. But we won nothing. The war continues in fragments, though no one is yet crazed enough to join the dots. And all I can see in this quiet hour is red wax stiffening on the candle into the faces of all the people that I love.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.